to stay up all night rather than risk dreaming. "How does this go?" I murmured, holding out various pistol bits, and she showed me how to rub down the individual parts with the oiled cloth. So when René Bourdelon needed to flee Lille, he became René de Malassis, I said eventually. And when he needed to flee Limoges, he disappeared again. How could that be so easy when so many collaborators were caught? I thought of the images I'd seen in the papers of such people, male and female, humiliated or worse. The old Frenchwoman hadn't spoken idly of hanging people from lampposts. René was no fool. Eve put away the gunwale with clumsy hands. He catered to those in power, but he always knew they might lose. And by the time he knew they would lose, he would have had a plan in place to wrap it away with his money and a new name, and start over. After Lille, and after Limoges. She paused, considering. I think he was planning the first of those bolts when he brought me here in 15. I didn't realize it then. He said he wanted to site out spots for a second restaurant. I assumed he meant expanding his business ventures. But maybe he wasn't ever thinking about expanding. Maybe he was scooping out a spot for a new life, in case he needed one. And he did. I laid out the last of the pistol parts, all oiled up. My hands were a greasy mess, but I'd gotten interested in the whole process. If they'd taught me to field-strip guns instead of baked biscuits in home ec, I might have paid more attention. You know, there's something different between René Bourdelon and René de Malassis, besides the name.
What's that, Yank?
Willingness to pull a trigger. I looked down at the Luger's trigger, lying innocent among the disassembled components. The way you described him in the first war, he was too fastidious to do his own dirty work. When he caught a thief in his restaurant, your predecessor, he called the Germans in, and they did the shooting. The second time around, from what that old woman said, he didn't hesitate to pull the trigger himself.
Not a small line to cross,
Eve agreed. She sounded like she'd already done considerable pondering along these lines. So what changed him? I asked. By the end of the First War, what turned him from a profiteering aesthete into... I remembered the old woman's words. An elegant killer. Eve gave a crooked smile.
I imagine it was me.
There was a piece of this equation I didn't have yet. But before I could ask, Eve gestured for me to reassemble the Luger, lips sealing. I changed tack. How will we find him now? He won't still be de Malassis. He'll have taken a new name again. I slid bolt into barrel. Where would he rabbit to from Limoges? And what a chill it gave me to know that we weren't just hunting an old profiteer, an old enemy, but a murderer.
There's an English officer I can contact, Eve said, allowing my change of direction. Someone from the old days. He ran networks of spies like me, and he kept on doing it through the next war. Stationed in Bordeaux, currently. I telephoned from London, but he was off duck hunting. He'll be back by now. If anyone can dig up information on an old collaborator, it would be him.
I wondered if this was the Captain Cameron she'd spoken of. He didn't sound half bad in the story she'd been telling. I wanted to get a look at him, see if he matched the internal picture I'd been building. But I had my own trail to follow. You contact your friend in Bordeaux, I said. I'm going to take Finn in the car and go look for my cousin. Eve cocked an eyebrow, even as she was showing me how to press the Luger's barrel down to take the pressure off the spring.
Look where for your cousin? If she's alive, she might be anywhere.
My aunt said she'd originally been sent to a village outside Limoges to have her baby. The kind of total backwater where people send disgraced girls. I was starting to get the hang of the pistol now. The parts were sliding easily in my oily fingers. Rose stayed there to have her baby, then 4 months later came to work here in Limoges. But maybe she left her baby back in the village with a family to raise. Maybe she went back there when she stopped working at Le Lité. Who knows? But it's a small town, and everyone knows everyone in small towns. Someone will recognize the picture of Rose. I shrugged. It's a place to start anyway.
A good plan. Eve agreed, and I flushed with pride at her approval. Take that pistol apart one more time.
I field-stripped the Luger again, and Eve began another story.
the weekend she and René Bourdelon had spent here in the summer of 1915. We came on the train, and he took me to buy a new dress. It was one thing for me to come to his rooms in a work dress, but he wasn't going to be seen on the promenade or at the theater with me in an old shirtwaist. It was a Poiré, almond green corded silk trimmed with black velvet, 43 velvet-covered buttons down the back. He'd count them off as he undid them. I reassembled the firing pin, wondering what Eve planned to do when she found her old enemy. Have him arrested. Everyone knew the French dealt harshly with collaborators. Or simply trust the Luger to make an end for her. I did not at all put that out of the realm of possibility. What did he do to you, Eve? And what did you do to him? She was telling me how the river in Limoges had looked gray when she was last here, not the bright blue it was now. How the leaves had fluttered around the heels of her new patent leather shoes, bought to go with the almond green dress. You remember it so clearly, I said, presenting her with the cleaned and oiled pistol.
I should.
Eve downed the rest of her whiskey.
That was the weekend I missed my monthly, and started fearing René had got me pregnant.
Chapter 22 Eve September 1915 Autumn had barely begun, and already the cold had clamped down like a vice. Lille was a city of two worlds living side by side, the falling temperatures making a demarcation clearer than any line. On one side the Germans, who had all the coal, candles, and hot coffee they needed. On the other side the French, who had almost none of those things. The two worlds had been described as French and German, or conquered and conqueror. But now they were simply cold and not cold. Eve didn't notice. She was pregnant. And the thought had driven every other from her mind. It hadn't been very long, but the signs weren't difficult to read. Two monthly bloods missed. Some women in Lille whispered that their courses now came irregularly, due to semi-starvation. But Eve didn't think she was so lucky. She'd grown thin as a wafer, but she still had enough black market scraps from Le Lité not to starve. Besides, other signs had been quick to follow. Her breasts had begun to feel tender. She was suddenly tired at all hours, and she had to swallow down unexpected shafts of queasiness when a juicy roast passed from the kitchens, or when she had to carry a pungent slab of Morbier in for the cheese course. Eve was certain. René Bourdelon had made her pregnant. It was a realization that should have driven her to utter despair, but there was no time for that. The Alice network was busy. French lines in Champagne had been pushing a sustained assault. The German commandant and his generals had spoken a good many terse words about it over their coffee. Words Eve reported. She marked hours waiting tables, and then marked more hours in René's bed. At work, one way or another, at least 19 hours of every day. She passed information about artillery placements, about casualty lists, about train schedules and supply depots. She was so used to the knife edge she walked that it seemed almost normal. She kept her face and her voice so continuously locked that she sometimes wondered if she had a single spontaneous expression left. She could not panic and fall into despair simply because her body had decided to betray her. She could not. Eve opened her door that Saturday to Violette, come to stay on her usual round through Lille, and nearly cried with relief. All week she'd had nightmares of Violette getting arrested, now of all times. Eve never much liked Violette, but oh, she needed her. Violette must have seen some flash of her relief, because surprise flickered behind those round glasses. "You look glad to see me," she commented, scraping mud off her worn boots. She frowned, adding, "Is there news?"
"No news," Eve said. "But I need help, and you're the only one I can ask."
Violette took off her gloves, rubbing her chilled hands as she looked at Eve curiously.
"Why me?"
Eve took a deep breath.
"Lily, she said you were a nurse."
"Red Cross, yes. Though not for long. The war had just begun."
Eve pushed down a sudden surge of doubt, but forged on anyway, because what choice was there?
"I'm pregnant," she said bluntly, and made herself look Violette in the eye. "Can you help me take care of it?"
Violette stared at her a moment, then let out an explosive breath.
Merde. Are you stupid enough to mix a love affair with work like this? Don't tell me you've fallen in love with Antoine, or I'm no idiot schoolgirl, Eve snapped. I had to sleep with my employer for information, Violette. Didn't Lily tell you? Of course not. Violette pushed her spectacles up her nose. You didn't think to take some precautions? I tried. They didn't work. Tiptoeing out of his bed at night to rinse herself out in his luxurious bathroom had felt more squalid than what took place in the bed. But Eve had never skipped doing it. If only it had worked. And before you ask, nothing else has worked either. Jumping down the steps, hot baths, doses of brandy, nothing. Violette gave another sigh, less explosive, and perched on the edge of the bed. How long? 2 months, I think. By Eve's best guess, it must have happened very early. Maybe just the second or third time. Not very far along, then. Good. Can you help me or not? Eve's heart lodged in her throat, and her voice rasped around it. I saw more battle wounds than pregnant women. Violette folded her arms tight across her chest. Why don't you tell Bordelon? A rich man like him, he might pay a real doctor. Eve had already thought of that. What if he wants it? She wasn't sure he would. René was hardly a family man. But Eve suspected he had something of a dynast in him. What if he decided Eve might have a boy, and found that thought interesting? If so, you could still get it taken care of on the sly. Telling you miscarried. Eve shook her head. She knew René. He hated mess and expense. To him, a mistress was something pretty that never caused trouble. Whether she miscarried a child he wanted, or he had to pay to get her taken care of, she was trouble. She might easily lose her place at Lilité. No, her best chance to continue her work for Lily was to have things continue as they were. Violette didn't suggest telling Captain Cameron or the other officers who oversaw the Alice network. You know the procedure can be dangerous. You're sure it's what you want? Eve gave a single violent nod. Yes. You might bleed to death, doing it this way. It's still early days. If you wait, you might still miscarry, or do it. Her voice came out in a desperate snarl. It was more than her determination to stay, to continue her work. It was the fact that behind her surface calm, Eve battled a panic bordering on madness. She'd given up so much since coming to Lille. Home, safety, virginity, even her name. And she'd done so willingly because it was for an unseen future. A sunny clearing somewhere safely beyond war and invaders. And now the invader was inside her, claiming her as thoroughly as the Germans claimed France. And there was no more future. At a stroke, she'd been rendered from a spy and a soldier, someone who battled enemies and saved lives, into just another pregnant woman to be unceremoniously bundled home and treated like a whore. Eve knew exactly what kind of future she could expect 7 months from now if she did nothing. Unmarried, unwanted, jobless, penniless, despised. Shackled for life to an invader seated by an enemy in the cold, starvation-racked hell of a war zone. Her body had betrayed her so completely, giving way to pleasure in a profiteer's arms, then keeping some portion of him when she'd tried so hard every night to wash away every trace. She was not going to let it betray her any further. Eve had spent weeks huddled in her cold bed, fighting the wild surges of blind panic and icy dread. And she knew she would happily risk bleeding to death for the chance to reclaim her future from the invader. Violette was nodding tersely. There's a surgeon in the network who treats people for us, she said as Eve stood battling her own emotions. He wouldn't touch something like this. He goes to mass every day. But I can borrow some instruments on a pretext tomorrow. Tomorrow, Eve said. Dry-mouthed. Yes. Sunday. Holy day. Blessed day. Ironic day, because it was the day Eve had decided to do something most men would call her a murdering slut for even considering. It could only be Sunday, because Lilité was closed Sunday. It meant she had a full day free to bleed and die, or bleed and recover. What happens if I die? Eve managed to ask when Violette arrived with her bag of borrowed instruments. During the procedure, or after?
I leave you here and never come back.
Violette was matter-of-fact.
I'd have to. If I tried to see you buried, I'd be arrested. Your neighbor would probably find you in a day or two, and then it would be a pauper's burial for you, while Lily notified Uncle Edward.
The sordid reality of such plans hit Eve like a knife thrust.
Well, let's get on with it then.
And try not to die.
Lie quiet.
Violet said it over and over that afternoon. Eve didn't know why. She lay quiescent as a marble figure on a tomb. Perhaps it was meant for reassurance. The bed was spread with a clean layer of sheets. Violette wore an apron with a crossover front, surely left from her Red Cross days, and her voice had a nurse's crispness. Instruments gleamed on a folded cloth, but Eve didn't look at them too closely. She pulled off her petticoats and underclothes and stockings, everything below the waist, and lay down. Cold. She was so cold.
Laudanum, Violette said, uncapping a tiny vial,
and Eve opened her lips obediently, swallowing down the drops.
There will be pain, I warn you.
Her voice was brusque, officious, and Eve thought of Lily saying, The habit of nagging, let me assure you, goes with a nurse no matter what she does. Right now, Eve found it comforting. Violette wiped down her instruments with something astringent. She cleaned her fingers with the same harsh-smelling stuff, and warmed the metal between her hands for a moment.
Doctors, she said, never warm their instruments. They don't realize how cold the metal is on a woman's parts.
The laudanum was already making Eve's head swim. The room blurred. Her body felt blunt and heavy.
Have you done this before? She heard herself ask from a distance.
Once, Violette said brusquely.
Earlier this year, Antoine's little sister, Aurélie. She works for us, escorting the couriers so the locals don't get suspicious. And she got caught at night by some German soldiers looking for fun. Only 19, poor thing. Her family came to me when they found out the bastard left her enceinte.
Did she survive?
This.
Eve looked at the instruments in Violette's hands.
Yes. And she went right back to work for the network afterward. A good, stout-hearted girl that she is.
If she did it, so can I, Eve thought. But she couldn't stop herself from flinching as she felt Violette's hands part her bare knees, and heard her say,
Brace yourself now!
Despite Violette's attempts at warming the instrument, it pierced Eve like an icicle. The pain, when it came, was sharp.
Lie quiet,
the order came, though Eve didn't move. Violette did something, Eve didn't know what, it all felt very distant. The pain bloomed, then faded away again, bloomed and faded. Cold. Eve closed her eyes, willing it all to go far, far away from her.
Lie quiet.
The instruments were gone. It was done, but it wasn't done. Violette was saying something.
Will be some bleeding now. You don't panic at the sight of blood, do you?
I don't panic at anything, Eve said through numb lips, and Violette smiled grudgingly.
You don't, I'll say that for you. I first saw you, and I thought you'd go screaming home to your mummy within a week.
It hurts, Eve heard herself saying.
It hurts.
I know, Violette said, and gave her more drops of laudanum. Bitter. Why did everything in Lille taste bitter, except what came from René? He was the source of rich food and delicious wine, and warm cups of chocolat, whereas everything shared with Lily and Violette was bitter and vile. In Lille, everything was upside down. Evil was delicious, and good tasted like gall. Violette was taking bloody cloths away, replacing the pads under Eve's hips and between her legs.
You're doing well, she said. Lie still.
Church bells rang outside, sounding evening mass. Did anyone go? Who thought prayer did any good in this place?
Lille, Eve said, and heard herself quoting Baudelaire. Its black enchantments, its hellish cortege of alarms, its cups of poison and its tears, its din of chains and dead men's bones.
You're rambling, Violette said. Try to lie quiet. I know I'm rambling, Eve replied. And I am lying quiet, you bossy bitch.
That's gratitude for you, Violette commented as she piled Eve with more blankets.
I'm cold.
I know. And Eve cried violently. Not from pain, not from sadness. From relief. Renée Bordelon had no more hold on her future, and the relief brought tears like a storm. By morning it was over. Violette had a list of instructions.
You might bleed more. Keep plenty of cloth on hand, clean cloth, and take this for pain.
The little vial of laudanum was pressed into Eve's hand.
I'd stay to keep an eye on you, but I'm scheduled to travel back to Roubaix today. There are urgent reports that need carrying across the border.
Yes. They had a job to do, after all.
Be careful, Violette. You said the Fritzes monitored your last trip too closely.
I'll travel a different route if I must. If Violette was afraid, and no one in the network could help but be afraid now, the Germans knew there were spies in the region, and the checkpoints had been hellish. She would never show her fear. Something she and Eve had in common.
Can you find a way to keep out of that profiteer's bed for a while? You need time to heal.
I'll tell him I'm having a bad monthly. He finds all that distasteful. That would buy at least a week.
Violette pursed her lips. How will you stop this from happening again?
Eve shivered.
I don't know. What I was doing clearly didn't work.
She could not possibly go through this again. Never.
There are devices, but doctors have to fit them, and mostly they won't fit on married girls. Take a sponge, soak it in vinegar, and push it up inside.
Violette mimed wordlessly.
Not infallible, but better than nothing.
Eve nodded. Thank you, Violette. A quick brushing gesture, sliding away the thanks.
We won't speak of it, not ever. You know what men do to women who do this. Not just you, but me for helping.
Never a word. They looked at each other for a moment, and Eve thought that if they were friends, there would be embraces now. They just exchanged nods as Violette pulled up her muffler and headed into the street. Yet perhaps they were friends anyway. Perhaps they were friends as men so often became friends, all gruffness and no light conversation. Only a shared and wordless understanding.
Good luck in Roubaix,
Eve called after the trudging figure, and Violette raised a hand without turning back. Later Eve wished she had hugged Violette. She wished that very much. Even getting up to wave at the door left Eve exhausted and head spinning. She crawled into her bed and stayed there, pulling her thin blankets up, stomach still cramping in long, slow rolls. A dull-edged pain that came and went in waves. There was nothing to do but endure, and sometimes weep. The tears rolled over her in waves too, coming and going like the pain. By the time night had fallen, she wasn't spotting blood anymore, but she still felt weak as a kitten. She sent a message to Le Letir complaining of a nasty flu. Renée wouldn't be pleased, but there was nothing to be done about it. Eve couldn't take an entire night on her feet, carrying plates back and forth from the kitchen. So she lay quiet, sweating her way through it, passing the time by field-stripping her Luger. It soothed her, the smell of gun oil and the coolness of the barrel in her hands. And she aimed it at nothing, and imagined putting a bullet between Renée's eyes. By the third day the Luger was the cleanest pistol in France, and Eve was cautiously convinced she wouldn't die. She went back to work, avoiding the glowering Christine, who clearly thought Eve should be fired for missing three shifts, but knew she wouldn't be. Eve made soft private apologies to Renée, knowing she looked so gaunt and ill that her story of a flu and a bad monthly were quite credible. And he did not invite her upstairs at the end of the night. Small mercies, Eve thought, wobbling home and looking forward to her room and her empty bed, even though it wasn't heaped with Renée's down-stuffed pillows. But the room, as Eve let herself in, was already occupied.
Don't mind me, Lily waved, listless. I'm just going to sit here and shiver.
I thought you were making the crossing to Belgium. Eve locked the door.
Escorting that downed pilot.
I did. Lily sat on the floor in the farthest corner, knees drawn up to her chest.
the worn ivory beads of her rosary wound tight through her clenched fingers. The pilot got blown up by a mine. I collected my messages in Brussels and headed straight back. The room was freezing, and Lily trembled in her white shirt waist and grey skirt. Eve pulled a blanket off the bed and dropped it around her shoulders. "You've got blood on your hem." "That would be the pilot." Lily's eyes were glassy, as though she was the one on laudanum. "Or maybe the woman walking in front of him, or her husband. We'd got all three of them." Eve sat down, drawing the blonde head onto her shoulder. It seemed there were worse nights to have than nights full of cold instruments and sharp belly pains and laudanum-laced waking nightmares. "The border searchlights light everything up like day." Lily's thumb rubbed along the rosary beads. "Once you get past the border and the shooters, there's the wooded area. The Germans mine it, you know. My pilot wouldn't stay behind me. He went running up to a couple walking in front of us. I think he thought the woman was pretty. They all three must have hit a landmine, because they just blew into bits not a dozen feet before me." Eve closed her eyes. She could see the explosion, the harsh lights. "And then I picked up my new passes from Antoine." Lily's voice was even, but her thin shoulders hitched under Eve's arm. "He reported that..." "Shh." Eve rested her cheek against the blonde hair that smelled like blood. "You don't have to talk. Close your eyes." "I can't." Lily stared straight ahead, tears leaking slowly down her cheeks. "I see her. The woman who stepped on the mine." "No. Violette." Lily buried her face then in her folded arms and began to sob. "Antoine gave me the news, little Daisy. Violette was arrested. The Germans have caught her."
Chapter 23. Charlie. May 1947.
"You're not invited to dinner," Eve told Finn and me. "Either of you." The telephone call she'd put through to her English officer had borne fruit. He was coming from Bordeaux tonight for dinner at the Hotel Café. Eve had been wearing her fierce mask ever since the meeting was confirmed, but by now I could see behind that mask just a bit. I'd been looking at her rather wonderingly since she'd told me she'd gotten pregnant. Pregnant? She'd been almost my age, caught in just my predicament. Only she'd been half-starving in a city full of enemies who would have marched her to a firing squad if they'd realized who she really worked for. Suddenly my little problem seemed a lot smaller in comparison. I knew what I'd been taught growing up, that what she'd done was wrong. But I couldn't manage to condemn Eve. She'd been swallowed up in a war. She did what she had to do. In truth, I admired her for carrying on after such a thing. I knew she'd slough off my admiration, though, so I just smiled. "Just tell me one thing. Is it Captain Cameron you're meeting tonight?" Eve shrugged, cryptic as always. "Aren't you headed for that village where your cousin went?" "Yes." 3 days we'd been in Limoges already. I'd have taken off for Rose's village sooner, but Finn had to do some more patient tinkering with the Lagonda's innards before he trusted her on the country roads. Today he'd pronounced us ready, and we were leaving Eve behind to await her mysterious dinner companion. "What do you think?" I asked Finn, sliding into the front seat. "Is it Captain Cameron she's meeting?"
"Wouldn't be surprised."
"Think we'll be back in time to see him?"
"That depends, doesn't it?"
He set the Lagonda's fuel-air mixture, advanced the timing.
"On whether we find out anything about your cousin or not."
I shivered, part anticipation and part fear, as we started down the street. "Today might be the day." Finn smiled in answer, driving us out of Limoges at a leisurely pace, one arm along the wheel. He wore his usual old shirt with the sleeves rolled up, but he'd shaved, his jaw smooth for once instead of stubble. And I wanted to reach over and stroke my hand down his cheek. I wanted it so badly that I had to keep my hands primly folded in my lap. How was it that the Lagonda felt more crowded when we didn't have Eve along? "We should be there soon," I said, just to be saying something. According to Finn's crumpled roadmap, our destination was only 15 miles or so west of Limoges.
"I reckon."
Finn steered the Lagonda past a fenced meadow where cows munched grass, a gray stone farmhouse in the distance. The outskirts of Limoges had quickly given way to quiet country roads and rutted lanes. It couldn't be more picturesque, and I sat there stiff as a board. I didn't know why I was nervous, just that I was. Finn had kissed me back when I planted one on him a few nights ago, but he hadn't made reference to it since. I wanted to move the game along, but I didn't know how. I might be a whiz with numbers, but I was a dismal flirt.
"What's this village called again?"
Finn asked, breaking my awkward swirl of thoughts.
"Ouradour-sur-Glane."
On the old road map, it looked like a tiny place. Hard to imagine Rose in a French hamlet too small even to deserve the word town. She'd always dreamed of Paris boulevards, Hollywood lights.
"New York in a pinch," I remember her saying. "New York chic enough for me."
And instead she'd come to Ouradour-sur-Glane, a hamlet in the middle of nowhere. The Lagonda rounded a corner, following a rough stone fence seeded with wild wallflowers, and I saw a little French girl walking barefoot along the top, arms out for balance. She had dark hair, but she instantly became Rose to my eyes, blonde curls dancing over a blue summer dress I remembered my cousin wearing long ago. A wave of premonition hit me so strongly it was almost certainty.
"You're at Ouradour-sur-Glane, Rosie," I thought.
"I know you are. Lead the way and I'll find you."
"We won't get there faster with you pushing,"
Finn commented, and looking down I realized I was pressing my cork-sandaled feet against the floor like it was a gas pedal.
"Why are you sitting like you're in church?"
"What do you mean?" The Lagonda came to a stone bridge, a bicycle passing over it in the opposite direction. Finn braked to let the bicycle pass, then leaned down, took hold of my ankles and swung my feet up onto the seat.
"You usually sit with your feet curled up."
I was blushing as he put the car back into motion. His fingers could circle almost all the way around my ankle. I wished my legs weren't so skinny. I wore a narrow red skirt I'd bought in Paris, and a loose white buttoned shirt like a man's that I'd pushed over my elbows and tied up at the waist, rather than tucking it in. And I knew I looked well in it, but I still wished I didn't have such skinny legs. Rose had nice legs, even when she was just 13. First thing I'd do if I found her was hug her till she couldn't breathe, and then ask if I could have her legs.
"We took a wrong turn somewhere,"
Finn said 15 minutes later.
"This is south, not west. All these unsigned roads. Here, wait a moment."
He pulled up outside a roadside shop with a display of postcards and a cat dozing on its step. The cat yawned as Finn stepped over it to address the proprietor in his rough Scots-accented French. "Rose and I could get a cat," I mused as the tabby washed its tail. My dearly departed Donald, God rest his soul, would never let me get a cat because they made him sneeze.
"I've decided I hate Donald," Rose said in my imagination. "Couldn't you at least invent a nice dead husband?"
"You're smiling,"
Finn said, dropping back into the still-running Lagonda. "Just wondering what you'll think of my cousin when you meet her." "Well, not really wondering. Everyone likes Rose."
"Is she much like you?"
"Not at all. Funnier, braver, pretty." Finn had been about to turn the car back onto the street, but he paused, giving me a long look out of those dark eyes. Finally, he turned off the engine, reached out, and pulled me across the seat up against him. Winding his hand through my hair, he put his lips to my ear.
"Charlie, lass."
His breath was warm, sending a spark of current through the entire surface of my skin as he kissed the beating pulse below my ear.
"You."
Kissing the point of my jaw.
"Ar."
Kissing the corner of my mouth.
"Brave."
Kissing my lips, very lightly.
"Not to mention pretty. Bonnie is a spring day."
"You know what they say about Scotsmen," I managed to say. "They're all liars."
"That's Irishmen. No blarney by a Scot."
His mouth found mine again, and he kissed me for quite a while. Dimly I heard a passing bicycle ring a bell at us, but I had my arms tight around Finn's neck, and my heart was thudding against his hard chest. Eventually he pulled back, though he still held me tight against his side.
"I could stay here all afternoon," he said. "But why don't we go find your cousin?"
"Okay," I said simply, and I had not been this happy in a long time.
You want to take the wheel?
I stared at him, and then I grinned. You'd trust me with the old girl?
Slide over.
We traded places. I stretched my feet for the pedals, still smiling. Finn took me through the startup.
If she was starting cold, you'd set your fuel-air mixture to slightly rich, but you can move it closer to center.
And eventually I turned the Lagonda back toward the west. She purred in my hands.
Funny, Finn said. The old man at the shop who gave me directions. He gave me an odd look when I said I was looking for Orador Soglan.
What kind of look?
Just odd.
I ran my hand along the Lagonda's wheel, feeling the soft cloth of Finn's sleeve pressed against my arm. The sun was warm on my head, and as I steered the convertible along the rutted road, I started humming La Vie en Rose. I never wanted to leave this car.
Look, Finn pointed,
but I'd already seen it, the looming shape of a church tower.
That should be it.
My blood fizzed as though it had turned to champagne. We'd traded places again as we got closer to Orador Soglan, since I was too keyed up to focus on driving. The road ahead wound toward the south end of the village, over the River Glan. I could see a church tower, low, squat shapes of stone buildings around it, telephone poles. I wondered why the roofs canted at odd angles.
It's quiet, Finn commented. No barking dogs, no rumble of tram cars. No bicycle horn sounding as we motored into the town's outskirts.
Finn slowed the Lagonda, but there were no children playing in the streets. I was more puzzled than anything else. But then I noticed the nearest house had black smoke marks streaking the stone walls, and the roof had fallen in. There must have been a fire, I said. But the marks looked old, washed by rain. Finn eased off the gas even more, moving the car at a near idle. The Lagonda's engine whined as though she were uneasy. I looked from side to side across the street. Still no people. More marks of smoke, of fire. I saw a clock lying on a sidewalk as though it had been dropped and abandoned. The face was half melted, but I could see the hands had stopped at 4.
Not a single one of these houses has a roof, Finn pointed.
And I saw more blackened timbers, more destroyed shingles. No wonder the silhouettes had looked strange from a distance. It had to have been a fire, but these were stone buildings, sturdy and well-spaced. How could fire jump between buildings like this? My fizzing blood had gone very, very heavy in my veins. The church loomed on our left, massive, built also from the heavy local stone. It too had no roof. Why hasn't anyone rebuilt? I whispered. Even if there was a fire, why hasn't anyone come back? The thought came at me like a shrieking train. Maybe there isn't anyone left. No, I said aloud, as though arguing with myself. A whole town doesn't die in a fire. People would have fled, and work had obviously been done in Orador Soglan after the fire, whenever it happened. There was no rubble, no debris. People had come to clear the buildings and the streets. So why didn't they stay? Why didn't they rebuild? The Lagonda crept through the center of town, past an abandoned post office, a tram station. The tracks looked as good as new, as if a tram would be rumbling around the bend at any moment. But it was so silent, not a footstep or the meow of a cat to be heard anywhere. Why were there no birds singing? Stop, I said unsteadily. I need to get out. I need to... Finn halted the Lagonda in the middle of the cobbled street. Who would honk a horn at them here to make him move? There was no traffic. I scrambled out, nearly falling, and Finn steadied me with a hand on my arm.
No wonder the man at the shop gave me an odd look.
What happened here? This was like a ghost ship abandoned at sea, with a meal still on the table. It was like a toy village with no dolls. Rose, where are you? We wandered back the way we'd come. I peered through the window of a burned-out hotel and saw furniture inside. Small tables thick with dust, chaise for waiting guests, abandoned countertops where desk clerks must have presided. If I went in, I'd probably find the half-melted bell on the counter, waiting to summon bellboys long gone.
"Do you want to go in?"
Finn asked. I gave a violent shake of my head. An empty market square or fairground loomed to our left. A car sat abandoned, rust showing around the doors. Finn ran a hand over the peeling fender.
"A Peugeot," he said. "Model 202. Someone's pride and joy."
So why would he leave it here? Neither of us had any answers, but the fear inside me rose higher with every echoing footstep we took. The church again, rising up behind the stone wall at the road, and a farther steep grass slope. A trio of arched windows loomed, looking like eyeless sockets gaping at us. Finn ran a hand over the lower wall, freezing in place.
"Charlie,"
he said.
"Bullet holes."
"Bullet holes?" He passed a hand over the set of pocked marks.
"Not rounds from country hunting rifles either. Look how evenly they're spaced. Soldiers fired these rounds."
"But this is a village in the middle of nowhere. Who would..."
"Let's get out of here."
He swung around with a white face.
"We'll ask at the next village. Someone can tell us what happened."
"No." I pulled away.
"Rose was here." "She's not here now, Charlie lass."
His eyes flicked up and down the empty street.
"No one is. Let's get out of here."
"No." But my skin was prickling all over, and the silence was driving me mad. And I was already taking a step in the direction of the Lagonda. I didn't want to stay any more than he did. That was when I saw a flicker of movement at the corner of my eye. "Rose!" It burst out of me in a scream. I couldn't see her face, but it was unmistakably a female figure, hunched and wrapped in an old coat despite the warmth, huddled on the grassy slope below the wall of the church. I tore away from Finn, sprinting around the lower wall, up the slope and around another wall, never taking my eyes off the figure. "Rose!" I shouted again, hearing Finn scrambling after me. But the figure at the church wall didn't turn. "Rose!" I cried a third time like an incantation, like a prayer, and my desperate, pleading hand fell on her shoulder. She turned. She was not Rose.
"Eve?"
I almost asked, though the woman looked nothing like Eve. She was plump, grandmotherly, with gray hair brushed into a bun. Why did she make me think of tall, gaunt Eve? Then her dark eyes found me blankly, and I saw the resemblance. She had the same ravaged gaze of a woman who had been harrowed and clawed to the soul. Like Eve, she could have been any age from 50 to 70. It was all the same to her, like the melted clock. She had stopped permanently at 4 in the afternoon. When this town had died, however it died. "Who are you?" I whispered. "What happened here?"
"I am Madame Ruffanche."
Her voice was clear, no old lady mumbling.
"And they are all dead, but me."
Sunlight warming my head, the rustle of grass, small everyday things made a backdrop for the quiet horror of Madame Ruffanche's voice. She wasn't even faintly curious as to who Finn and I were, nor did she seem surprised to see us. She was like the chorus in a Shakespeare play. The curtain went up on a set so strange and horrific the audience could not comprehend it, at least not until she walked out, and in a calm, dead voice, explained the scene. What had happened, when it happened, how it happened. Not why. She did not know why. I suppose no one could.
"It was 44,
she said as we stood beneath the eyeless socket windows of the half-burned church.
"June 10th. That was the day they came."
"Who?" I whispered.
"Germans. Since February, an SS Panzer division had been stationed north of Toulouse. After the Allies landed in June, the division headed north. On June 10th, they came here."
Pause.
"Later we learned that someone had reported Oradour-sur-Glane as sheltering resistance fighters. Or that Oradour-sur-Vair was... I don't know. It wasn't ever clear."
Finn took my hand, his fingers ice cold. Go on, I managed to say through stiff lips. Madame Rufranche did not need to be told. The story was begun. She would tell it until the end, and then walk off the stage again. Her eyes saw past me and through me to the 10th of June, 1944. It was about 2 in the afternoon. German soldiers burst into my home and ordered us, my husband, my son, my 2 girls, my granddaughter, to the fairground. She pointed toward the square where he'd seen the abandoned Peugeot. A number from the village were already assembled, men and women flocking in from all directions. All the women and children were ordered inside the church. She stroked the pocked, smoke-streaked stone as though it were a corpse's brow. The mothers carrying their babies in their arms, or pushing them in prams. Several hundred of us. Not Rose, I thought sickly. Rose could not have been among them. She wasn't a village woman. She was living and working in Limoges. I'd been so certain I'd find her here, but not like this. She couldn't have been here on June the 10th.
We waited for hours, Madame Rufranche continued calmly. Speculating, whispering, growing more afraid. Around 4 o'clock.
4. I thought of the melted clock.
A few soldiers entered. Just boys, really. They carried a box between them, with strings hanging out of it that trailed on the ground. They set the box in the nave, closest to the choir, and they lit the strings. They retreated, and the box exploded. The church was full of black smoke. Women and children were running everywhere, shoving, screaming, choking.
She sounded flat as a printed page. I wanted to put my hands over my ears to shut out the words, but I stood frozen in horror. Finn, at my side, was not even breathing.
We broke down the door to the sacristy and flooded in. I sat down on a step. I was trying to get low, to the good air. My daughter ran toward me, and that was when the Germans opened fire from the doors and windows. André was killed where she stood.
Pause. Blink.
She was 18.
Pause. Blink.
She fell over me, and I closed my eyes and feigned death.
Jesus, Finn said quietly.
There were more shots. And then the Germans threw armloads of straw and firewood and broken chairs in a heap onto the bodies lying on the flagstones. There was still smoke billowing. I crawled from under my daughter and hid behind the altar. There were 3 windows high in the wall behind it. I went to the middle one, the biggest, and pulled up the stool the priest used to light the candles. I heaved myself up to it as best I could.
This hunched, grandmotherly woman had clawed her way up a sheer stone wall, over a floor thick with bodies and a miasma of smoke and bullets. I didn't know what look Madame Rufranche saw on my face, but she shrugged.
I don't know how. My strength was multiplied. That happens.
Finn was almost inaudible.
The window was already shattered. I pulled myself up and flung myself out. I fell about 10 feet.
She looked up, directly over our heads to the dark and gaping middle window in the church wall.
Here.
My throat choked with an unborn scream. Here, the word echoed, here. This woman, 3 years ago, had flung herself out of this window, down onto this patch of grass where we now stood in the fragrant sunshine. Here.
A woman tried to follow me. The Germans opened fire as soon as they saw us.
Madame Rufranche began to walk, her steps slow and difficult.
I was hit 5 times. I crawled this way.
We followed her mutely around the church wall.
I made it to the sacristy garden. The plants weren't dead then. They were growing thick.
We stood among the flattened weeds, looking at the barren garden.
I hid among some rows of pea plants. I heard more shots, more screams, more shouting. That's when the men and the boys died, most of them. Gunned down. And then there was the rush of fire as all the roofs were kindled.
Night fell, and then came the sound of champagne corks popping. The Germans stayed the night, and they drank champagne.
My lips parted, but no words escaped. I didn't think there were any words.
Finn turned his back abruptly, but he didn't release my hand. He gripped so hard my fingers felt like they were breaking, and I gripped him back.
Madame Ruffonche looked past us serenely, her fingers working as though she were fingering non-existent rosary beads.
The Germans stayed a few days. They made some attempt to dig pits, hide the bodies. I never knew why. No one could hide it, what they'd done. Such a stench of burned flesh. Panicked dogs running everywhere, looking for their masters. The Germans killed most of us, but they had a soft spot for the dogs. They didn't shoot any.
They dug a pit here for the dead in the presbytery garden, and it was so shallow a man's hand was still sticking up from the earth after they'd filled it in.
I looked at Finn. He was still turned away, shoulders heaving. I didn't know why I couldn't move, couldn't make a sound. I was frozen.
By the time the Germans gave up cleaning and made their retreat, I'd been rescued. Two men who sneaked back into the village, looking to see if their sons had lived. I begged them to take me to the river and drown me, but they took me to a doctor. I was in hospital a year. When I came out, the war was done, and the Germans were gone. But the village was still...
Pause. Blink.
Like this.
Pause. Blink.
I lived, she continued matter-of-factly. Others, too. Men who'd crawled out of the burning barns after being shot. Men who were in the fields or gone to neighboring towns that day. A few children who hid in the ruins or escaped the gunfire.
There was something struggling to the surface in her eyes. She looked as though she were rising slowly back to the present from the island of time that was June 10th, 1944. She looked at me for the first time as if she actually saw me. Saw Charlie St. Clair in her red skirt and cork sandals, standing in the wreckage of all the ghosts. Finn turned back.
Why do you come here?
He gestured at the empty, smoke-stained buildings around us.
Why do you stay?
It is my home, Madame Ruffonche said. It is still my home, and I am its living witness. You are not the first people to come here, looking. It is easier to find me than nothing at all. So tell me who you are seeking. I will tell you if they lived.
Her eyes were pitying, bottomless.
And I will tell you if they died.
For a long moment, no one spoke. We stood like eternity in that terrible place, a soft breeze ruffling Finn's hair and rippling the hem of Madame Ruffonche's coat. Then I reached into my pocketbook and took out the worn photograph of Rose. I put it into Madame Ruffonche's lined hands. I prayed then. I prayed so hard. She peered at the photograph, holding it closer to her old eyes.
Ah, she said quietly, recognition flowering in her eyes.
Hélène.
Hélène,
Finn said it sharply before I could.
Hélène Hubert, she said her name was when she came here to have her baby. A widow. Very young. I think we all guessed, but...
A shrug.
A lovely girl. No one cared. She left her baby with the Ivernaux family while she went to work in Limoges. She was back every weekend on the tram, Madame Ivernaux said.
A smile.
Hélène. A pretty name, but we never called her that. She said she'd been Rose as a child, for her pink cheeks. So we called her that. La Belle Rose.
Something in me started to shriek.
Please, I begged, and my voice cracked. Tell me she wasn't here. Tell me she was in Limoges. Tell me she wasn't here.
A long silence from Madame Ruffonche. She looked at the photograph, Rose's laughing face, and I saw her sinking again. Back down to the endless loop of June 10th, June 10th, June 10th.
Inside the church, she said. There were three windows high in the wall. I went to the middle one, the biggest, and pulled up the stool the priest used to light the candles. I heaved myself up and flung myself out. I fell about 10 feet.
Almost exactly the same words she'd used telling it the first time, I realized in my daze of horror. How many times had she told this story to people like me, people looking for loved ones, that her tale had hardened into such a rigid sequence, the same words in the same order? Was that how she kept herself sane while she raked over her memories every day for our benefit?
Madame, please.
She was walking again, back the way we'd come, her steps uneven and mindless. I ran to keep up.
A woman tried to follow me out the window.
Pause. Blink. Then the tale changed as we came back to the dark, broken window where Madame Rufange had jumped 3 years ago.
When I looked up.
She looked up now, and my eyes flew to follow hers. I saw what she described. I saw what she'd seen.
I'd been followed by a woman who was holding out her baby to me from the window.
I saw a blonde head, pale arms reaching down from that window. Here.
I took the child. It was screaming in fear.
I saw the wailing bundle, the waving fists.
The woman jumped, falling down next to me. She seized her baby from me and turned to run.
I saw the slim figure jump, graceful even in terror. I saw her white dress against the grass as she gathered herself up, grass-stained and blood-stained, snatching the screaming bundle in her arms and darting toward safety.
But the Germans fired at us, dozens of shots. We fell.
I saw the fusillade of bullets, the hazy drift of gun smoke, the chips of stone flying as the church wall was hit, the drops of blood on blonde hair.
I was hit 5 times. I was able to crawl away.
Madame Rufange put the photograph gently back into my shaking hand.
But your friend, La Belle Rose and Baby Charlotte, they were killed.
I heard a rustle then, and I closed my eyes. It was the rustle of a summer dress rippled by warm wind. Rose was standing right behind me. If I turned, I would see her. I'd see her white dress, stained red. I'd see the bullets that had gone through her soft throat and her sparkling eyes. I'd see her lying crumpled, legs twitching as she still tried with all her brave heart to flee. I'd see her child in her arms, the baby I'd never met. The baby who would never grow up to be a big sister to mine. The baby she had named Charlotte. Rose stood behind me, breathing. Only she wasn't breathing. She'd been dead 3 years. She was gone, and all my hopes were lies.
Chapter 24. Eve. October 1915. She died in a hail of bullets. The details bled from smuggled newspapers, and everyone read them, sickened and fascinated. She was executed by firing squad in Belgium, a Red Cross nurse and English spy, instantly famous, heroine and martyr to all. Her name was everywhere. Edith Cavell. Not Violette Lemeron. Edith Cavell was dead, but Violette, from what the Alice Network could glean, was still alive. Cavell looks like Violette, Eve said, devouring the forbidden newspaper in private. Cavell had been arrested in August, but only now had the execution marched to its brutal conclusion. It's the eyes. Most of the pictures of Edith Cavell were romanticized. She was drawn swooning before the row of guns, her photographs touched up to make her look fragile and feminine. But Eve thought the eyes were anything but fragile. Edith Cavell had helped smuggle hundreds of soldiers from Belgium. It was no job for the fragile. She had hard, matter-of-fact eyes like Violette, like Lily, like Eve herself. Another fleur du mal, Eve thought. This is good. Not to be brutal, but Cavell's death is nothing but good for Violette. Lily was pacing the room. Since Violette's arrest nearly 3 weeks ago, she'd been lying low, hiding out with Eve. Hiding didn't suit her. She paced like a caged tigress, her small face tense.
The Germans are being so condemned for Cavell's execution. They won't dare march another female out before a firing squad. What are they doing to her?